is The Fall Line. Last year, we began an exploration of how databases created by citizens and not government officials are changing both the way the general public accesses and interacts with cold case information. So far, we've brought you discussions with Todd Matthews, who founded the DOE Network and who was instrumental in the establishment of NAMIS, the National Missing and Unidentified Persons System. Todd was also one of the earliest, perhaps the earliest, online citizen sleuths who used the internet to help identify a Jane Doe. His work helped to identify the decedent, formerly known as Tent Girl, as Barbara Ann Hackman Taylor. We've also interviewed Anita Lucchesi of Sovereign Bodies Institute. Anita set out to do what no government has managed, or even tried to manage, to record the cases of missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit people in North and South America. We first became aware of Anita Lucchesi's work with the Sovereign Bodies Institute when we were trying to find any meaningful statistical information on missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls in the southeastern United States. Since her first days working on the database, Sovereign Bodies has expanded into not only a system for tracking the missing and murdered, but also a community service organization that serves families affected by the loss of loved ones. Last year, we also spoke with Thomas Hargrove, the inventor of the algorithm that drives MAP, the Murder Accountability Project. We talked about his nonprofit and how he uses data to identify hotspots of violent activity across the United States. Thomas's algorithm uses law enforcement and FBI data to track murders, who, where, when, and by what method, and the clearance rates in metropolitan areas. Based on the results, he and others in his group can identify troubling patterns that indicate serial killers or other hotspot activity, often before law enforcement has acknowledged, or perhaps even noticed, the pattern themselves. We also interviewed our colleagues at the TransDoe Task Force about their new database, LAMP, which stands for LGBT Plus Accountability for Missing and Murdered Persons. It's the very first database of its kind, a way to track the missing and murdered, including unidentified persons, or DOEs, in the LGBTQ plus community. Like Sovereign Bodies, LAMP is a private database. In this case, its purpose twofold. One designed for official access, and also focused on providing friends and chosen family of the missing and murdered a way to give details about their loved ones. LAMP seeks to correct the errors that so often appear in how LGBTQ plus cases are handled, like misgendering, dead naming, or the failure to include chosen names or out-of-date physical descriptions that can lower the chances of locating or identifying a missing person or a decedent. Today, we bring you a database a little different than the others. If you work in the true crime sphere, we have no doubt that you've used this resource before. It's what we like to call the Encyclopedia of the Unidentified. Nick Wagler, its creator, is more to the point. He calls it Unidentified Wiki. Like most wikis, it's a more user-friendly and better formatted version of the original Wikipedia that we're all familiar with. A website with entries on a given topic which are easily searched or cross-tagged and can be edited and added to by the public. For those who aren't familiar, Wikipedia itself has fairly stringent rules as to what is deserving of its own Wikipedia page. If a user flags a page for not being important enough for an entry, it can be pulled down, which is why smaller web hubs hosting wikis on various topics have sprung up. The biggest ones are no doubt fandom-related, everything from television shows like Unsolved Mysteries to Pokemon, but there are also wikis devoted to more serious topics. Unidentified Wiki is one of those. Hosted at fandom.com, Unidentified Wiki is a super-focused and ever-growing collection of the cases of unidentified decedents from all over the world. Unlike NAMIS, you don't have to know the internal case number assigned to a DOE to find them. That's similar to the DOE Network, which will include commonly used names, whether that be a name used in the media, like the Lincoln County Jane Doe or the Twiggs County John Doe, or a nickname like Tint Girl or Delta Dawn. But something that sets Unidentified Wiki apart from the DOE network or from any other database out there is its user-friendliness and usability. It doesn't aim to take the place of NamUs or of DOE network. In fact, this resource specifically hopes to send readers and researchers to those databases to find as much information as possible. Rather, it wishes to serve as an encyclopedia page, gathering as much information as possible on any given case. Photos, forensic art, case details, links to other databases, pertinent news links, all in a single place. Then, the case is cross-listed via tags, location of victim, decade of discovery, details of case, presumed sex and ancestry, age estimate, and other aspects, such as whether a decedent was recognizable at the time of death, or if a victim was disabled or fell into a certain age range, that will make pages sortable into different lists. And any details a family member may recognize, like clothing or a physical description, are easy to spot. The result is simple, readable, and incredibly customizable. It's a research tool used as a landing page and hub by law enforcement professionals, academics, journalists, and others in the true crime community. On a single page, links to official sites and law enforcement information are gathered, and forensic sketches or composite photos, or even postmortem photos that have been released, are stored. It's funny, but this simple approach is miles more navigable than anything provided by the government, which is perhaps why so many of us working in the field share its links first when we're discussing cases. And for podcasters like ourselves, who spend a lot of time working with cases of DOEs, this is an invaluable resource. We can find cases based on nicknames, counties, half-remembered details, something that was often impossible before a Wisconsin native named Nick Wagler decided to stop contributing to Wikipedia and turn his attention to Unidentified Wiki. It's such a vast and complex project that we were shocked to find out that its creator, Nick, began his work in contributing to True Crime Encyclopedia entries in high school and launched Unidentified Wiki, which is hosted, as we said, on fandom.com, while most of his peers were worrying about graduation. Nick actually started contributing to Wikipedia as a middle schooler on any topic that interested him, but he soon became fascinated with true crime. Growing up, he watched reruns of shows like Forensic Files, 48 Hours, Unsolved Mysteries, and found himself drawn to the unsolved cases. The ones that seem to have the least information and the most mystery inherently embedded, DOE cases, where the victim's identity was unknown. By the time he made it to high school, Nick had discovered Todd Matthews' site, the DOE Network, and begun to volunteer. He was in awe of the incredible work that went into gathering information for the pages there. But as a person who's on the cusp of millennial and Gen Z, Nick was also familiar with the usability and flexibility of sites like Wikipedia, pages that linked easily from one to another, categorization fields that allowed a user to sort and hyperlink with ease, and an open format that allowed anyone with a passion for casework to contribute. At the same time that he'd begun volunteering for the DOE Network, Nick's own Wikipedia contributions had ramped up. He'd hoped to expand the online encyclopedia's entries on unidentified decedents. But when one of his own entries was taken down because it was not considered notable, that is, a subject worthy of its own page, Nick decided to act. Thus, Unidentified Wiki was born. Nick's work, and the work of his co-administrators, who are international volunteers, has allowed us to continue the work on this podcast, and for me to work on my forthcoming book on DOE cases. Unidentified Wiki is a unique database, open to the public, carefully sourced, and ever-changing. It's uniquely designed for and by the people it serves, citizens who want to learn more about cold cases, and those who hope that they can aid in resolving them. We spoke with Nick in December of 2021 about his work with Unidentified Wiki and what he hopes to accomplish with the project, one that has taken an incredible amount of effort. It's something he manages between full-time work, school, and his podcast, From the Vault, which he co-hosts with creator Jason Futch. On the podcast, Nick and Jason have covered some of the cases Nick's written about on Unidentified Wiki and interviewed some of the forensic experts he's featured on the site, like Carl Koppelman, the self-trained artist who works with DNA Doe Project. They've also had Todd Matthews on to discuss his work on Doe Network. Our discussion with Nick lasted 4 hours, longer than we can share with you here, but we wanted to start by giving you a feel for how the site can be used. I began our conversation by describing how I might search Google for a particular case and what I'd stumble upon on Unidentified Wiki. I chose an unidentified decedent we've been working to cover for months now, a woman known as the Lincoln County Jane Doe. She was a presumed sex worker, or so the men who admitted to killing her told police, when she was allegedly picked up along a highway in Mississippi. Her murderers assaulted and killed her, and left her for dead further down the road. When they were apprehended, they told authorities they didn't know her name. If you'd like more information on the case, we've included a link to Unidentified Wiki in our show notes, but just a warning, there are postmortem photos included in the entry.
If I put Lincoln County Jane Doe into Google, what comes up for me first or even second hit will be Unidentified Wiki. And if I go to that page, I will get all the information that's available on her. And when I say all the information, what I mean is a write-up of the case, photos that are available with warnings if necessary. I'll get links to NamUs, Doe Network, Charlie Project, usually some links to one or two news articles and also citations for the write-up. And one thing that I also always see are categories or tags. I can put in pretty much any case I've ever thought of to look up. It gives me a home base or a landing spot for any case I want to begin to research. Is that kind of what you intended?
I would say so, yes. I think maybe at the beginning it was more of just me being fascinated and craving to learn more and to kind of put it all together to tie in as much as I can from other sources, which is what I did a lot when I was contributing to Wikipedia. I started working on Wikipedia when I was 12 years old, and that sort of helps form how I researched certain topics. I wanted to sort of share that with the world to bring awareness to this topic. I was very unaware of just how many Doe cases there were in the world until, you know, I was at the end of my high school career.
That ties into why we cover so many unidentified cases on the Fall Line. And a big part of that is that unidentified cases tend to get the least coverage because there's not an inherent narrative because we don't know the person's identity at the time. So there's not family to speak to. And of course they have a past. And of course they have a life. We just don't have access to it. And that's where the story is. So by trying to gather all the information we can, that's how we try and create a narrative to get people interested, to try and get them to pay attention, to get the story out there. That's exactly what you're doing with Unidentified Wiki.
I wanted to convey this information in a more visual fashion that's comprehensive in terms of a narrative of the discovery, a very brief synopsis of the case at the very beginning at the top of the page, along with circumstances of a discovery and investigation kind of organized in these little headings like Wikipedia is. I think that it can be a little more accessible to some degree as far as to navigate to other sources to get to sections that are perhaps what a reader is looking for. I really, really like the info box feature that we have. It's a little table that has generally the approximation of the victim in life, as well as the relevant locations, dates, cause of death, condition of the remains.
And I feel like that's what is really valuable to me. The thing I wanted to point out for listeners is the category tags that Unidentified Wiki has. You might tag a case based on geography. You might tag a case based on presumed sex or the ancestry of the victim. You might tag the case based on cause of death. And so any victim might have anywhere between 8 to 15 tags, right? Was that a feature from the beginning, or was that something that developed as you went along?
At the beginning, I would say more of the more specific, basic categories like race or discovery dates were you know, it's sort of how Wikipedia is laid out, where they have deaths by strangulation in Washington or 1985 births, 2020 deaths. I sort of, at the same time, wanted to broaden things out a little bit more and have them more specific to the world of the unidentified that could potentially show some cases that have something in common that maybe others wouldn't initially notice. Like, there are a lot of people between the ages of 25 and 30 who are being discovered in lakes in a certain state, or to even provide a reader with the chance to discover a new unfamiliar case to them that might be similar to the one that they're interested in, that they're reading about, that is close to their heart.
And it's actually allowing people like myself, academics and researchers, to do research in the site.
And that's something I never really thought about when I first started doing that.
I've been using your search function specifically because I'm looking for cases that have to do with how we could better identify people and the different methods we've used to try to identify people and sort of where they failed and where they've worked out well. And I've been looking specifically at certain identification methods that are outside of things like forensic art and DNA. And I've been using Unidentified Wiki to do some of that. And I actually found it more helpful than other sites.
That is amazing to hear. And, you know, it's something I never, ever anticipated, that this true crime nerd end up creating such a site that has grown this large and is, you know, well known. And yeah, hearing that, it's very surreal.
You filled in a gap, a huge gap, which is that it's very difficult to find the cases of the unidentified, because on a county and state level, there's not great communication. Some counties have their own websites, some don't. Some state agencies list all of the unidentified in their states. It's rare. I know, at least in our state, where we have a very strong state agency, we still don't have all the states unidentified listed there because the state agency has to be invited in, you know?
And there is, you know, significant lack of some cases even being entered, depending on how old they are, or even regionally. There are some states that have no cases listed. I guess it's sort of more interesting in a way when you can find a case on Unidentified Wiki or maybe even on the DOE network that hasn't been added to NamUs yet. It kind of gives you that additional uncertainty that's in a way almost more alluring, that this is a case that is less likely to be known by the average person scrolling through NamUs, maybe looking for a potential match to a missing person if they're a sleuth that's intending on contacting law enforcement with a potential tip. I think generally as a whole, what really brought me into the topic of unidentified individuals is that uncertainty, that mystery. There's so much that needs to be known, but it can't be determined. It can't be established who this person is, why they ended up in the side of a highway or buried behind this house 50 years ago, or various different scenarios.
As a young teenager, Nick had exposure to the citizen sleuth community, both on Reddit and web sleuths and other places online. That's how he discovered the work of people like Todd Matthews and artist Carl Koppelman, and saw regular people, sometimes anonymous, sometimes not, working to match missing persons to unidentified decedents. We asked Nick how Unidentified Wiki might play a role in aiding in that research and in case closure.
When you designed Unidentified Wiki, were you thinking about people like yourself? Do you consider yourself to kind of be one of those sleuths? What are sleuths in that sense, and what do sleuths do?
So I guess I would probably define a sleuth as, you know, the everyday civilian who isn't directly employed or affiliated with law enforcement or an investigative agency, but they have the desire to sort of help move a case along if they have that ability, if they have an idea that could be relevant to the case that maybe investigators haven't thought of, to be very enthusiastic about the topic, but maybe have no formal education in this field, yet they're able to self-educate themselves enough to become more familiar with the way things work throughout the process of identifying someone or perhaps following a lead that could close a case. I had initially sort of a sleuthing element to the site where there was a section that would give out a couple of theories as to, you know, maybe Beth Doe, who has, of course, now been identified as Evelyn Cologne. I remember one example, I had added a theories section that suggested maybe she was killed by another woman who was involved with the father of the child she carried, which obviously not the case now. That was a very early theory of mine when I had yet to really sharpen my sense of how criminals would act and behave. But another more popular concept was comparing an unidentified person to an existing missing persons case, which I think that was influenced strongly by my time on the Web Sleuths website, which oftentimes has a lot of interesting information on it, such as news clippings. Sometimes you have to take it with a grain of salt where it seems like wild speculation. And that is basically what led to my decision to stop including just theories, just speculation that might not be relevant.
It seems like a difficult choice, but a good choice in terms of what it's turned into. It's trustworthy. Everything that's there is cited, and the sources are newspapers or well-researched podcasts or law enforcement documentation. And then you always link back to NamUs, Doe Network, instead of providing a place for people to talk about their sleuthing. If they want to do that, they have a source of objective information, which can be more and more difficult to find, honestly. And I think in the true crime world, it can be really easy to end up in a place of questionable ethics. So it seems like you kind of avoided that.
Yeah, in the past, I did have this commenting feature where anybody could comment, you know, I think this John Doe looks a lot like so-and-so who was reported missing out of Saskatchewan when they're found in Florida. Sometimes there are points that are made that do make sense, but at the same time, it's sort of like, where is this coming from? Prior to when it was decided to disable the commenting feature on the site, there was an individual who commented on this one article on a teenage boy who was killed in a hit-and-run accident in California, that the NCMEC rendering that we had available on the site looked like her missing brother from the same town, from the same year. And this has never been confirmed by the family, by law enforcement, by anybody really like directly involved in the case. But, you know, that comment seemed very genuine. And it took, I believe, 3 years for it to finally be confirmed, but it was that missing boy. And that was something I never envisioned. I think I've sort of kind of gone back and forth with saying, yes, I helped solve the case. It was something I never envisioned happening to that level, that somebody could read something that I've written and recognize somebody. Of course, I give NCMEC full credit for the identification because they did a fantastic rendering of him.
I think it's totally fair to say you participated in that identification. I think that building a huge website that makes stuff accessible to people that wouldn't otherwise find it, and then them finding it and recognizing it, I think it's absolutely fair to say that you participated in it.
One of the most useful aspects of Unidentified Wiki is the effort Nick and his contributors have made to gather forensic art and case photos for their entries. When he first began, that often meant directly approaching the artists themselves. Because some of that work is not being produced by law enforcement agencies, but rather by citizens who'd taken it upon themselves, as volunteers, to improve outdated or missing art for cases. It was vital to Nick that he gain that permission. As you'll hear, plagiarism and ownership and usage rights are topics he has carefully considered.
I've already mentioned that we have a common friend in Todd Matthews who runs the Doe Network, but we also both know Carl Koppelman. And for those in the audience who don't recognize his name off the bat, I think you will recognize him when we get you to think back to Julie Doe, who we covered in season 3. Julie Doe was a trans woman who was murdered in 1988 in Florida. She had some really unfortunate forensic art. And how I became familiar with Carl was the beautiful new forensic art he made for her. And one thing about Carl that I think is really important is, like our friend Kelly Lawson from the GBI, he makes new forensic art that makes you want to look at the person, which is the purpose of forensic art. You're supposed to want to look at the picture and study it. And he especially goes back and does forensic art for cases where the art is outdated, or perhaps the art is not an accurate representation, the art's been destroyed, or maybe he is just a more talented artist. Can you talk a little bit about how you met Carl? And because his work's featured really prominently on your site, sort of how that came to be.
So it was probably a little bit after I had started extensively reading Doe Network entries that I came across Web Sleuths. And there was this one artist who was doing his own renderings. And they were easily identifiable because he had always used actual photographs behind the artistic rendering of the kind of the area where the person was discovered. I later learned that was Carl Koppelman. And he was a very prominent user on Web Sleuths. He's a moderator. And I realized he did a lot of reconstructions on a lot of subjects who would have their postmortem photos available either on Namus or on other sites relating to law enforcement, some of which were probably leaked when they shouldn't have. But he was concerned how a lot of these renderings that were released that were on law enforcement websites, on Namus, etc., they appeared to be very inaccurate because of their focus on capturing the expression the person wore in death, which is oftentimes distorted because of the discomfort they felt as they died, whether it was from homicide, natural causes, exposure, and definitely added a lot more of a visually appealing depiction of these people that a lot of other artists didn't do. I started to kind of just admire Carl. Eventually, I got to the point where I reached out to him over, I believe it was over Facebook. I asked permission if he could upload his renderings to Wikipedia because I had written a lot of entries based on cases that he had done renderings for. What I love about Carl is that you can have a very lengthy conversation with him as if he's somebody that you have known in person for years.
I know that certainly your own articles on Unidentified Wiki are cited themselves. I've seen the citations in them. But have you actually had issues with your own work being plagiarized?
I would have to say that there are occasions where I do see material that might appear on a different site that may have been directly copied from maybe an entry that I had written. I'd actually experienced this with a Wikipedia article I'd written on the Lady of the Dunes case when I was, you know, I'm this 17-year-old with no degree, not even a high school diploma, when I had written the article. And this one news article had basically directly copied and pasted a paragraph of the article that I had written. And I kind of found it amusing and irritating at the same time because this person was getting paid for something that a high schooler had written. I guess I've always felt like I've had a pretty good sense of wanting to be sure that what I would write myself would be in my own words, that it wouldn't be a very close likeness to something that somebody else had already worked very hard on to produce. Sometimes when you are tasked with describing the individual's clothing or personal items, that can get a little difficult to reword and to make your own. But I have gotten to the point to where I've actually removed large portions of entries on Unidentified Wiki because they were very, very similar in wording and structure to that of other sources, including the Doe Network or Namus or the Charlie Project.
Like everyone working in this field, whether they're a volunteer or a professional, Nick has thoughts about how we could better serve the unidentified, how to resolve their cold cases more effectively.
Do you think the U.S. could approach the cases of unidentified decedents more effectively? How could we get more cases in front of larger audiences? And by that, I mean, how could we ultimately get more cases solved?
The biggest thing I've been preaching for years is that there needs to be so much more media attention, you know, beyond CNN sharing the isotope results of Buckskin Girl's jacket or her bones. So many of those documentaries that are out there tend to focus on solved murders or those who were quickly identified. Oftentimes, if there are unidentified victims in, for example, a serial killer case, they're oftentimes just a side note or they're overlooked completely and omitted from the episode. And I feel like with this giant explosion of true crime documentaries that are popping up all over streaming networks, all over television, to get these unsolved cases much more attention, much more exposure, there are plenty of opportunities to do this, but it still doesn't happen as often as it should. One thing that I really, really was disappointed by was how the program Who Killed Jane Doe, which was on an Investigation Discovery, was canceled after its second season when it was the first television series, at least that I was aware of, that aired on TV that focused on Doe cases. And, you know, a lot of the episodes featured individuals I was very familiar with, such as the Tent Girl case, who was identified as Barbara Taylor. And then other kind of lesser known cases such as Deanna Criswell or Brenda Giroux. And Brenda Giroux's case was one that I was very familiar with because I'd written the Wikipedia article on her case. And I just remember just how well they did with interviewing the family. I remember just breaking out into tears at the end of the Brenda Giroux episode because seeing these additional photos of her smiling and just showing how vibrant and beautiful she was and how her life was tragically cut short. I think it really brought a lot of emotional elements to the table that I think helped motivate people to speak up if they would have any information or relevant tips that could help solve these cases. I think more awareness as to how the public can help, not only just by watching these programs, by paying attention to details. You know, genetic genealogy is something that's very useful, that is revolutionizing the world in forensics. But at the same time, it is expensive to get a usable profile to upload into those databases. And I know a lot of times the organizations doing the research on these cases to get the file or to get the sample, to get it processed, to get it enhanced if needed, it takes a lot of time, it takes a lot of money, and you know, oftentimes cases can be stuck in that fundraising for an extensive amount of time because there aren't enough people that know they have the opportunity to donate to help raise the funds because a law enforcement agency cannot, you know, provide the thousands of dollars needed for a new sample or to even exhume a body that has been buried for a quarter of a century. And I feel like it's kind of an interesting thing to see how, for example, the DNA Doe Project will have a list of their donors. So yeah, I think that's definitely one way, another way to sort of help bring these cases to light to the public eye that, you know, they can even have some interaction and involvement with helping solve the case by donating rather than just watching a television show for entertainment purposes.
I mean, I think the point to get people on TV too, though, is important. We have websites and podcasts, but in my process of writing this book about unidentified persons, the lack of major media coverage for unidentified cases, and by that I really do mean TV, documentaries, the percentage of true crime that's about the unidentified is very small. And to get people involved in donating to these cases, they have to know about them.
Exactly.
We have different databases. We have yours, we have NamUs, Doe Network, Charlie Project, Sovereign Bodies, which is incredibly needed. Do you feel that even with what we have, there's still a gap in terms of searchable information on unsolved cases? And if so, what is it and how could it be filled?
So I feel like one major thing, as somebody who's actually very interested in the topic of victimology, linking potential victims together, what they had in common that could potentially lead to a suspect or at least link the crimes together, is, you know, I guess to have more information as to if they could be related to crimes that have been solved where the perpetrator has been identified. That, you know, maybe this skeleton found in the bushes in a rural area could be the work of a well-known offender that, you know, everybody thinks has been long since put to rest and locked away forever. But I also feel like one major problem is interaction between law enforcement and private citizens, because a lot of times private citizens can have very useful ideas that an investigative agency might not be aware of. I know one example that I went through myself was several years ago, I had emailed one of the investigators on the Buckskin Girl case, who was later identified as Marcia King. But I remember reading that the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children had, they of course are well known for documenting cases of children, but they oftentimes did include individuals who could have been as old as 25. Generally, that's the most common age threshold that I see, is about, you know, 15 to 25-ish. And Buckskin Girl was 18 to 26. And I remember emailing the investigator who was listed as a contact person on NamUs and suggesting, you know, NCMEC does this really, really high-tech, very realistic looking images of the deceased. I remember the agency was receptive to that suggestion, saying that they would consider anything to really move the case forward because it had been cold for so long. And I remember when NCMEC released the new images of Buckskin Girl, I was jumping up and down in front of my computer because it was just phenomenal to see this image that could easily be mistaken for a photograph depicting this young woman in color when all of her other photos were black and white. And, you know, they even provided funding to aid with pollen testing and isotope tests. All of a sudden, she was all over the news. Ultimately, it was genetic genealogy that solved the case. Yet, that sort of exposure to the media, where they did get additional leads, anything that could be valuable to the investigation, all happened because the Miami County Sheriff's Office was willing to take a suggestion from an everyday civilian who just happened to be interested in true crime.
If you had unlimited resources, how would you further develop an unidentified wiki?
I think in terms of informational resources, what would be fantastic would be access to all these potential police files that are oftentimes accessible through the Freedom of Information Act, which does unfortunately require the process of submitting the request, or, you know, archived newspapers that can be obtained without a subscription to newspapers.com, or even to documentaries that, you know, may require you to subscribe or, you know, access to streaming services. I've actually lately been rewatching the original Cold Case Files series, and I've discovered a lot of information that was not available anywhere else, such as case details or even, you know, photographs of the victim in life. And that's very, very useful. I could go on and on about just how much I wish I could get all of this information that is, you know, either archived and removed from the internet or requires money to obtain.
What can our listeners do to support Unidentified Wiki?
Quite honestly, I think one of the best ways is if you're interested in writing about cases or, you know, correcting information that you think is outdated or incorrect, join the website. if you've noticed that there's this case that you're interested in that is not on the website, you can go ahead and create it yourself. And that's what's very important, just to get as many cases as possible added to the site in order to bring awareness. So many are overlooked and forgotten, especially in high population areas such as Florida or Texas that have a great deal of unsolved DOE cases.
Thanks so much to Nick for speaking with us today. If you can contribute to Unidentified Wiki, please consider working on the pages. Nick would appreciate it. And be sure to check out From the Vault, the podcast that he co-hosts. If you know of a case that should be covered on the Fall Line, there's a link to our case submission form in the show notes. Thank you for listening. The Fall Line is a fully independent show, and we appreciate listener support. It allows us to do research, obtain FOIA, pay our content advisors, and support and donate to the causes we care about. If you try out the products we advertise, please use our sponsor codes. It really helps. And if you'd like to support the show and the stories we cover, join us on Patreon. We're raising Patreon funds to continue to pay for the Millbrook Twins billboard and to build a therapy fund for families who've been on the show. Each and every one of our patrons helps us continue this work, and we're so grateful for your help. On Patreon, you can get early release ad-free versions of our regular episodes, starting at only $5 a month. We've also added blogs and live streams, which all patrons can enjoy, starting at just a dollar. The Fall Line is written, hosted, and researched by Laura Norton, with additional research by Brian Waters, Kim Fritz, and Kiana Burgess. Interviews by Brooke Hargrove. Produced, engineered, and scored by Maura Curry. Content advisement by Brandy C. Williams, Liv Fallon, and Vic Kennedy. As always, our most special thanks to Angie Dodd. Currently, our monthly donation is going to Private Investigations for the Missing. Please join us in supporting this nonprofit. They need funds to help families access the service of PIs.